the regime's embassy in Amman in solidarity with Gaza and the Hamas resistance movement. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces are stepping up their attacks on the Gaza Strip, killing and wounding a number of more Palestinians. Gaza Health Ministry says at least 32,414 Palestinians have been killed since March 7th. Moti Abu Musab, our correspondent in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala, updated us on the latest Israeli onslaught on the besieged territory.
Let's begin from Rafah city, as the Israeli occupation forces intensify their attacks against the residential buildings and the areas, particularly those adjacent to the Egyptian border. We are talking about at least three residential buildings were destroyed by the Israeli successive airstrikes that hit the western part and the eastern part of the Rafah city. At least nine Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over those continuous and successive attacks and airstrikes. Needless to mention that those attacks are still continuous so far. When it comes to Khan Yunis city, as you know, the current Israeli aggression against the western part of the city, particularly the vicinity and the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex, is still continued so far, with more airstrikes and more artillery shelling that reached that area. And we are talking about also continuous attacks that are still hitting the residential buildings and the residential areas there, knowing that the vast majority of those buildings were completely destroyed and devastated by the chronic Israeli airstrikes that reached and targeted that area when the Israeli occupation forces carried out their first ground offensive against that area, inflicting more damage and destruction. According to multiple eyewitnesses, that the Israeli occupation forces opened their gunfire directly towards the Palestinian civilians. After releasing them, they were kidnapped from the Nasser Medical Complex, and after that, they were shot dead by the Israeli occupation forces in a continuation of the continuous Israeli crimes and massacres. Over the last night, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained against the northern part of Nusayrat refugee camp and the east part of Al-Burij refugee camp. At least two Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over those continuous and intense attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip. When it comes to Gaza City, as you know, the Israeli aggression is still continued against the western part of the city, particularly the vicinity and the surrounding areas of the Shifa Medical Complex. More attacks are still hitting those areas.
Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank have become almost daily occurrences. Over the past several months, the regime troops have carried out new raids, including a drone strike on the city of Jenin and its refugee camp, killing several more Palestinians. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, who gave us more details on the issue.
A 19-year-old Palestinian was shot and killed by the Israeli forces during a military raid to Jenin, a city. Now we are speaking about two more Palestinians had been killed, but this time they were killed by an Israeli drone strike. Israeli military carried out a drone strike at an area in the neighborhood of Ad-Damaj in the refugee camp of Jenin, killing two more Palestinians and wounding at least nine others. Those two Palestinians who had been killed, one of them is from the city of Nablus and the second is from Jenin refugee camp, and they were killed in this drone strike. This brings the number of the Palestinians who were killed by the Israeli forces in Jenin since the early hours of Wednesday to three. We have to mention that the Israeli forces had also stormed the town of Qabatiyeh in Jenin. Exchange of fire had been carried out between Palestinian members of the resistance groups and the Israeli forces. The Israeli troops, as usual, they used their guns to shoot the Palestinians. At least five Palestinians had been wounded, according to paramedics. This means that the number of Palestinians who had been killed since the 7th of October is today over 450, maybe specifically 453 Palestinians, in addition to the fact that thousands had been wounded by the Israeli forces. Over 7,800 Palestinians had been arrested across the occupied West Bank since the 7th of October.
In a fresh retaliatory attack, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has fired a salvo of missiles at the Israeli city of Kiryat Shemona in the occupied territories. Home was damaged and two settlers were wounded in the strikes. A plume of black smoke was seen rising over the targeted site. The attack followed an Israeli air raid on a medical facility in southern Lebanon. Israeli warplanes targeted the emergency and Islamic Relief Center in the town of Hebariya, killing several paramedics. Hezbollah had condemned the act of aggression and vowed to avenge the attack. Tensions remain high between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Both sides have been exchanging fire, but Israel has intensified its attacks on civilians in Lebanon in recent weeks. Our correspondent Mariam Salas says the Israeli regime plans to evacuate settlers from the city of Kiryat Shemona, which has been the latest target of the Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement in its retaliatory attacks.
We know from Israeli media that the rockets hit their target. We're talking about some 30 Katyusha rockets that landed in what the Israelis call the city of Kiryat Shemona, which is a very large area. Big portions of it has already been evacuated by the Israeli authorities. Now we know that the rest will also be evacuated seemingly after this targeting. The Israelis said that there is at least one factory that was in flames. There was one settler that was killed so far. Others that were severely wounded. Even those firefighters and the paramedics trying to get still people from that factory that were stranded inside. They were also wounded as a result of trying to extinguish the fires and remove the settlers inside the factory. We know that there are still rescue efforts as we speak in the city of Kiryat Shemona right now. In addition to the fact that Hezbollah also said they targeted the barracks, which is the command center for the 769th Division, which is also very significant. Now, you notice that the Israeli media is completely blocked out from any sort of casualties when it comes to the military.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has carried out new operations against Israeli targets in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Iraq's Islamic Resistance said the first operation targeted the Ovda air base in the occupied Palestinian territories using drones. In the second operation, resistance drones hit Israel's Speer military site, also in the occupied territories. The Iraqi resistance said the operations were carried out in response to the latest massacres of the people of Gaza by Israel. Iraq's resistance groups have conducted numerous operations against Israeli targets in recent months. They've also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in response to Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, thousands of Jordanians have once again filled the streets of the capital Amman to vent their anger at the U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Since the beginning of the war and aggression against Gaza, we have been here in the courtyards of Al-Kaluti Mosque in order to send a message to the Palestinian resistance that we are with you and all the Jordanian people are with you. And from here, I appeal to the Jordanian people who are sitting at home for everyone to go out to the streets. What are you waiting for? We must make our voice heard. There is no need for all this attack by security forces. We have one enemy. Here, there is land for the occupier, the Israeli embassy, and we are here to demonstrate against this land.
This was the second night of violent protests in Amman, with people demanding the government sever all kinds of ties with the Israeli regime and stop the country being a transit for goods into Israeli-occupied territories. They were chanting slogans in support of the Palestinian Resistance Movement and its military wing, Al-Qassam Brigade. Security forces used batons and tear gas to disperse the angry demonstrators who tried to reach the Israeli embassy on Tuesday evening and during the early hours of Wednesday. Security forces also arrested a number of demonstrators, including at least one female. Jordan, which hosts 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed several rallies in solidarity with Gaza since Israel launched its war on the besieged strip. The country has also been actively involved in airdropping humanitarian aid into Gaza. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Rumsia, who's joining us from Bethlehem, also co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Mr. McNapier is joining us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Rumsia and Bethlehem. I want to get your perspective on these massive and serious demonstrations that are taking place in Jordan. The demonstrators and protesters who are participating in these rallies, which have been ongoing since the Israelis started this genocidal war against the Palestinians, has been persistent, not just in Jordan, but in many other Arab governments as well. Please break that down for us and the impact that that has had globally, and also given the support that the Jordanians are showing for the Palestinian cause and the anger that they're showing against the Israelis, why are we not seeing any action from the Jordanian government?
Well, to start with, I can say, you know, salute to the Jordanians, Palestinians in Jordan, and internationals in Jordan who flooded the streets of Jordan demonstrating against this genocide that's ongoing, ecocide that's ongoing, etc., and demanding that their government takes good position. So I salute them, I respect them, and as Palestinians here in the occupied territories, we are very grateful to them. For the Jordanian government, I say shame on you that you are repressing your own people from demonstrating, from showing what international law expects from the Jordanian government and people, which is to stop this genocide. So this is to start with. Now, in terms of what is happening in Jordan, I think it's shown that 6 months into this fighting, so to speak, which is genocide, with the resistance showing heroic resistance in Gaza, it is clear that the people in the streets of the Arab world, the Muslim world, and indeed all over the globe, hundreds of millions of people, that these movements are growing, not diminishing. They are increasing their pressure on their governments. And this is a very good sign, and is a very important sign to stop this. Enough is enough. 6 months after the start, from October 7th of this onslaught and massacres in Gaza, it's time to stop it. So we, again, you know, I salute them, I appreciate, we Palestinians appreciate all of this. And I hope the Jordanian government stops repressing its own people, stops allowing trucks of aid to Israel, and instead insists on trucks of aid to Gaza, not tokenism of dropping some things from the air to show that they are doing something.
Mr. Napier, I want to get your perspective on the same issue as well, about these demonstrations that are taking place in Jordan, and also if you may expand on these unprecedented pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli demonstrations, public demonstrations that we've been seeing worldwide.
I mean, it's very clear from everybody who measures it that Israel and its European and American allies are very, very isolated. And, you know, in terms of the whole world, the vote at the UNSC was just one stark example of that. Even the British government felt compelled to vote against Israel. But within those governments, within those countries, those governments also are very isolated from their own populations. And we can see this across the USA and across Britain and Europe as well. But Jordan's very special. To see those vast crowds on the streets of Amman, I think in Washington they'll be looking at this and getting very worried. They're already worried that the genocide in Gaza is like an acid eating away at the status quo. That in millions and millions of homes across the region, people can see Palestinians being killed only because they are Palestinians, and Zionists are already selling the land in Gaza as real estate and to other settlers. So people can see that they're brothers and sisters, but in Jordan it's their cousins and their relatives who are being massacred in Gaza and in the West Bank only because they are Arabs. And the Jordanian regime, of course, has been complicit in the Zionist project since 1948, but certainly until the present day. Now, what happens next? I think everything now hangs on the next few days, because people who know about these things describe how, in this situation where the popular forces are being repressed by the paramilitary police, everything depends upon the determination and the resoluteness of the mass of demonstrating in order to break the will of the repressive forces. Somebody who really knows about these things describes how, in the Russian Revolution, for example, as crowds of desperate people approached the Cossacks, the repressive forces, one of the guys winked at the ordinary people. And he said, the road to revolution runs under the belly of the policeman's horse. And when those repressive forces in Amman break, when they can no longer beat the demonstrators, when they go home and their families berate them and say, what are you doing? This is massacre, this is genocide in Israel and Palestine, and now you're beating the Palestinians here on the streets of Amman. Sooner or later, that repressive force will break. Now, Iranians know about this under the Shah, that it was a terrible cost that they paid, but finally the repressive forces were defeated at very high cost. So in the streets of Amman, I think something's being played out, which, when you take into account that in Yemen, the Yemenis are coming to the aid of the Gaza people, that this is happening right across the Middle East, the fear, the desperation, the rage at the genocide that people can now see on their TV screens, then there's everything to play for. But I think it depends on two things. It depends on the resoluteness of the Palestinian and Jordanian people to pursue and to let the police know that if they come over to the crowd, they'll be welcomed. But if they don't come over to the crowd, there will be a price to pay. It's a balance, and we see this playing out time after time after time in history. It's a moment of great fear for people in Washington, for people in London, you know, for the governments. They will be looking at this and thinking, will the whole place follow Amman and follow Yemen? Israel's already contained on its northern border, and now on the border with Jordan, there's a real fantastic ferment. I think it's glorious. It's the possibility of victory for the Palestinians if this can spread, and you know, it will also influence the behavior of governments in Washington and elsewhere to put more pressure on Israel for a ceasefire.
All right. Thanks, General. That's all the time we have for this segment to the program. Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Rumsia joining us from Bethlehem. And thanks to co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. Mick Napier, joining us from Edinburgh. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the 8th day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. As we had promised you, today we will go to Shiraz to make you familiar with the customs of Nowruz of the people in this beautiful and globally famous city. Stay with us, please. Shiraz is one of the most beautiful cities in Iran. This city is the destination of trip for many travelers in Nowruz, as the weather is good and everywhere one can feel the arrival of a spring. Shiraz is home to a variety of ethnicities, mainly Fars, Azeri, Lor, and Arab. Each of these ethnicities have certain customs and culture contributing to prosperity of the culture of Shiraz as a whole. Natives of Shiraz speak Farsi with the Shirazi dialect. Most of the people in the city are Shia Muslims, while small minorities of Jews and Christians have also lived there since old times. Shiraz is renowned all over the world as the land of poem, culture, garden, flower, and nightingale. Sa'di and Hafez are the two poets of Shiraz who have gained international fame for decades. They are the honor of Shiraz and Iran, and their poems have been translated to scores of languages. Traveling to Shiraz in spring is accompanied with the fragrance of bitter orange, that is citrus orontium blossoms. The people of Fars province, especially the provincial capital of Shiraz, welcome the arrival of spring a few weeks before. They clean their houses, buy new clothes or fabric to sew new clothes. People of Shiraz usually pay a visit to the shrine of Shah Chiragh, a descendant of the Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him. They have other customs like preparing ash, a special kind of broth, and Fale Hafez, which means fortune-telling with the Divan of Hafez. In other words, they open a page of Hafez's book of poetry randomly and read the poem. They believe that the implication of that poem will be the fate of the person in the coming year.
Thank you.
Going to fish ponds is another custom which used to be held in three cities of Shiraz, Fasa, and Zargan, but as the pond in Fasa has dried up, there are only two ponds for the custom. 10 meters below the tomb of Sa'di, there is a qanat with compounds of phosphorus and quicksilver. Qanat or qanat is an underground aqueduct which transfers water to the surface. It flows into a pond called Hoz-e-Mahi, fish pond, underground. The pond is on the left of the tomb. The interior is octagonal and reaches the yard of the tomb with 28 steps. Before the time of Sa'di and even in ancient Iran, there was water here and the water was sanctified. According to the 14th century Muslim traveler Ibn Battuta, the pond was constructed by Sa'di. Today, people of Shiraz go to the pond, which is full of red fish, and cast coins in it with the hope of achieving their aspirations. But the people of Zargan gather around the pond and put a big pot on fire to make ash. People of Shiraz start exchanging of visits from the morning of the first day of spring. They are no exception to other ethnicities in going to visit the elderly first. Some elderlies give the young ones a plate containing roasted wheat, sesame, roasted chickpeas and raisin. Another plate is also given with a sweet bread and painted egg. In the past, singers used to go from door to door in the morning of Nowruz to visit the needy and congratulate them. They would tell them sweet stories to make them happy, and both would pray for each other. Another custom among the people of Shiraz is the symbolic wedding of bitter orange. Bitter orange is one of the most beautiful trees in Iran. It is found everywhere in Shiraz. The sweet fragrance of the blossoms of this tree remain indelibly in the minds of every visitor and tourist as a memory of Shiraz. Any house with a bitter orange tree holds a wedding ceremony for the tree, no matter if the tree yields fruit or not. The wedding of bitter orange tree stems from the story of a woman who wanted to cut down the tree as it was not fruitful in a certain year. In this custom, neighborly women are invited and the landlady takes a saw to cut a twig of the tree that has become unkind. One of the women plays the role of a go-between to prevent her. Then, they spread a thin lace over the tree, sprinkle special sweets over the tree while singing and enjoying themselves. Thus, the tree is made bright and they believe that it will yield fruit next spring. In the final part of this episode, we are going to name some of the foods common in Shiraz during Nowruz. Some of the foods of Shiraz in Nowruz are shekarpolo, sweet rice, ash sabzi, vegetables broth, tarhalva, a kind of halva, and ash karde. These foods are palatable for visitors and tourists. Other traditional foods of Shiraz during Nowruz include ash anar, pomegranate broth, قرمه به, a kind of stew with chopped quince. دو پیازه, made with onion, potato and curry. یخنی نخود, a kind of delicious broth. یخنی, عدس کلم, broth with lentil and cabbage. کوفته هلو, made with meat, onion, saffron, sugar, plum, walnut, etc. The naming of this food is because of resemblance of the balls after preparation. The Shirazi cuisine includes other foods too, but what is famous not just in Iran but in most countries is Salad Shirazi. Its primary ingredients are cucumber, tomato, and onion. Then it is served with lime juice, olive oil, spices, and so on, based on the taste of individuals. It is somewhat similar to Pico del Gallo and Mediterranean salad. The last but not least, mention should be made of Falude Shirazi, which is very tasty and enlivening. It is made with starch, half-frozen syrup of lime, sugar, and rose water. Then it is usually served with black cherry juice. It creates an unforgettable memory for every tourist and traveler.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Not facing a U.S. veto this time, the U.N. Security Council finally called for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, which has so far fallen on Tel Aviv's deaf ears. Israel defiantly insists it will perform an operation on Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have taken shelter. This has faced global criticism and stern warnings, even from Israel's closest ally, the U.S. In the meantime, truce negotiations are still ongoing in Doha, Qatar, though with no breakthrough. So far, Israel's Holocaust in Gaza has killed more than 32,000 Palestinians. Some 500,000 Gazans are already facing starvation, and many more are on the brink. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, is joining me from London. Also with us is Shabir Rizvi, political commentator in Chicago.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me welcome both our guests. Welcome, both of you. So, beginning with Kim. Kim, you're a lawyer. At last, the U.S. abstained, deciding not to use its veto power at the U.N. Security Council. What in your mind's eye motivated Washington to do so? And does this mean a change of heart in its policies vis-a-vis the Tel Aviv regime? Is it a publicity stunt or what?
Yeah, good afternoon to you. It seems to me that after I've analyzed the situation very carefully and I've been thinking about it and I've listened very carefully to the speech of the U.S. representative at the U.N. Security Council as to why they have abstained, it is very obvious to me, and I don't know about others, but it's very obvious to me that it was a publicity stunt. The U.S. is aware that the whole world is now totally against its position in relation to supporting this genocidal regime. And it has lost a moral compass, it has lost the moral authority, it has lost a great deal that perhaps we can't even measure it at this stage. And therefore, it has decided to take this position make it seem like it is concerned and it wants the right thing to happen and so forth. But when you listen to the speech of the U.S. representative at the Security Council, you will see that her entire focus and attention was on basically blaming and deflecting, blaming the whole delay in getting the resolution voted on the Chinese and the Russians, and forgetting completely that they themselves three times vetoed a proposal to end the genocidal campaign of the Israeli regime. And so it seems to me that this was clearly a political stunt, because if they really want to stop the genocide, the Holocaust in Palestine, today all they have to do is make a phone call, and I'm pretty confident that they will be obeyed, because they will be able to cut military aid, they will be able to cut all kinds of other aid, they will be able to put to bear a huge pressure on them, they will be able to sanction them. Okay. So it is this stunt doesn't work, and I am not persuaded. I don't know about others.
Okay, now, Shabir, all UN Security Council resolutions are considered binding, and this is in accordance with Article 25 of the UN Charter, which is ratified by the United States. But this one, the U.S. has described the Monday resolution as non-binding. How's that?
Yeah, that's certainly interesting. I mean, I think if we need to actually analyze history, there are actually dozens of UNSC resolutions that Israel has violated. Time and time again, we see it with the West Bank, we see it with Gaza, we see it with Lebanon. This is an occupation that cannot be trusted. And so what the United States is doing is they're saying it's non-binding. Why are they saying it's non-binding? Because they know right now Israel has become a pariah state. And not only has it become a pariah state, in the eyes of the international community, I would say, a lot of us have known from the very start it's been a pariah state. But all eyes are on Israel. Its image has never been more tattered. Its image has never been this horrific in the eyes of the international community. So what the United States is doing right now is saving face of its most loyal junior partner and saying that these are non-binding, in that it knows that Israel is going to violate the ceasefire resolution, whatever its terms may be. In fact, they're already violating it. There were several bombings last night. There were several massacres last night. And so what we see is that Israel is very much intent on continuing this carnage. And so, for one, the United States is trying to save face. And two, we know that from the get-go, the Israeli occupation will not honor this resolution, no matter what its terms may be.
Right. Now, Kim, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has canceled a visit of a ranking delegation to Washington, seemingly in protest at Monday's UN Security Council resolution, you know. And Bibi's already facing division among cabinet members, also opposition from the Israeli people who've been out on the streets for a long time, holding rallies against him and his policies. So would he, in your opinion, eventually get off his high horse, or would he still persist to act stubbornly?
I think this act of canceling his visit to the U.S. is just another one of those media game that they play to make it seem like, you know, they are now in a tiff. But that's not true, because if they are in a tiff, the genocide, the Holocaust would stop tonight. And that's a fact. Everyone knows it. And we don't need to be mincing our words about that. And this man's life, livelihood, political career, everything, together with his wife also, who's been accused of certain things, depends on continuation of this Holocaust in Gaza, because up to now, 6 months later, all he has achieved is damage the reputation of Israel in the world, cut its own possible benefit that it may have derived from any other sources if they had taken different course in relation to dealing with October the 7th. And so he's now in a situation where he hasn't achieved any of his objectives from the time he entered Gaza, other than committing a Holocaust that people are now comparing it to the Nazi Germany of Second World War. And so him pretending that he's not going is to give America some kind to give America some kind of gravitas to, in the world platform, to make America seem like, you know, it's now taking a very firm stance towards Israel. And the reality is far from that. If it wants to take a firm stance, is for them to say, stop it now or else we are going to apply sanctions on you. We're going to send our troops there to you to make sure that you don't invade, what you're threatening to do in Rafah. And do that kind of thing. They have done that many times before in relation to many other people, but not in relation to Palestine, because they are a party to this Holocaust. The U.S. regime is a party to this Holocaust. So is the U.K., unfortunately. Yemen is the only one that is upholding the international rule of law.
Right. Now, Shabir, officials in Tel Aviv have taken no heed of the U.N. call for ceasefire, nor have they abided by the ICJ ruling. So what else can be done to force the regime to stop this genocide or Holocaust or whatever else you call in Gaza?
Yes. So as we know, Israel is a pariah state. It doesn't care for what international mechanisms are being used against it. And so what it's going to have to come down to is that countries will have to take a bold stance. They're going to have to economically cut ties with the Zionist state. They're going to have to cut political ties with the Zionist state. They will have to turn to their own workers and their own local businesses and say, you cannot do business with the Zionist regime. This is what it's going to have to come down to. That, and of course, uplifting the resistance and politically backing the resistance. Because as you know, under international law, resistance against an occupying enemy is completely justified. As soon as that justification is made well known, and it's honored internationally, as we saw China made similar comments a few weeks ago, we are going to see slowly but surely, sort of just like how South Africa, apartheid South Africa, you know, was diminished, the same diminishment of the Israeli regime. Right now, it's basically being politically, as it always has, it's being politically backed and militarily backed by the United States. As soon as countries are able to independently say we will no longer do business with the Zionist regime, that is when that first domino will fall, and it will create a cascading effect that's going to take care of the Israeli regime, that's going to make it eventually fall, because it cannot stand on its own two legs without any political and economic assurances from basically the Western world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, let's now review Israel's failure in the Gaza war. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is now in Tehran, and he says that Palestinians have shown, in his words, legendary resistance in the war, and that Israel has failed to achieve any of its military objectives. Let's face it, you know, it's a fact. IOF has failed to defeat even one single Palestinian resistance group.
Yes, you know, this is remarkable. It's been 75 years or so that this regime has been applying this genocidal schemes, because genocide is not a one-off action of one party against another. Genocide is a thing, is a process, a thing that takes time. So over the past 75 years, they have been applying this genocidal policy towards the Palestinian people, yet, remarkably, they remain steadfast, strong, and carry on their resistance operation, which is their inalienable right guaranteed by the UN Charter. And occupied people are entitled to do whatever is necessary to resist the occupation. And the occupation doesn't have rights. The occupation has obligations to preserve the lives of the occupied, to protect them, to do all kinds of things to make sure that their human dignity is not usurped from them. And so, yes, indeed, I totally agree that they haven't achieved any of their objectives, especially in relation to the current genocidal campaign. They haven't freed any of the hostages. They haven't eliminated Hamas, as they claim that they were doing. Instead, they were just applying collective punishment policies, killing everybody. And it is harrowing to hear what the UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, says today. She says, this is the genocide is in Gaza is so conspicuous and so ostentatious. And she's absolutely right. I'm quoting her verbatim there. She's absolutely right, because it's live. It's unfolding before the eyes of humanity all over the world. And yet these guys are arrogantly carrying on, and they assume that they're going to achieve something. And they are not going to. I totally agree with those who say that the people of Palestine have shown a remarkable, very moving fortitude and resilience and ability to resist their rather horrific, monstrous, nasty occupying force.
Right. Now, Shabir Rizvi, Ismail Haniyeh, saying that political support for the Tel Aviv regime is waning, and he cited the UN Security Council Monday resolution demanding a ceasefire. So we have pro-Palestine rallies in full swing around the world, as you know. We have Israel's allies, even their closest one, turning their backs. Boycotts of Israeli-made goods by a large number of countries underway. Severance of relations or limiting relations, summoning ambassadors, filing lawsuits in international fora. So what else could be in the offing?
Yeah, we're seeing multiple cascading effects of the October 7th resistance operation. Hamas has basically bloodied the nose of Israel to such an extent that they will never, ever be able to recover. I think what's going to happen now is a tightening of these different types of resistance that we're seeing, whether that's resistance directly on the ground from groups like Hamas or the PFLP, whether it's boycotts expanding. As you can see, more companies are being targeted to the point where sometimes even shipping lanes are being blocked, airports are being stopped by groups here in the United States, and there's just more general political pressure being added onto specifically the United States political apparatus. As you can see from the primary results coming in, a lot of voters are saying that they're uncommitted to Joe Biden, specifically as a protest vote, due to his direct complicity in this genocide. And I think that's where it hurts the political system the most, because Joe Biden has been the number one backer of this genocide. If it were not for his policies, this would not have gone to the extent that it has. Now that the political pressure is being applied to the number one financier and the number one political backer of the Zionist regime, things are going to start changing. And it's not only just the voting that's going to be taken into effect. If you look at what's happening on the ground in the United States, politicians are being made uncomfortable. They're having these fundraiser events where activists are popping up and shutting down the fundraiser event. Roadways are being blocked. Highways are being blocked. Entire docks are being blocked. And I think the United States is at risk of losing its own political legitimacy if it keeps backing this genocide. Because as you can see, there's millions of people on the streets collectively, not only in the United States, but across the entire world. They all support Palestine. In fact, the only people that are supporting the Israeli cause are specific Zionist groups, people that are tricked into supporting Zionism, and of course, the United States ruling class, who seeks to make, as Jared Kushner said, a port could, lead to a lot of revenue for the United States capitalist class. The people of the United States are directly at odds with their own ruling class. So why would they support something? Why would they support Israel when they know that Israel is committing this genocide, is in bed with the ruling class that oppresses them day in and day out? There's no reason to support this. And the longer that the United States digs its heels into this genocide, the more contradictions arise between the population of the United States and the government of the United States, which clearly shows that it does not have the interests of the people at hand. It does not have the interest of peace and security at hand. Rather, it has the interest of a few select billionaire elite that want to expand their operations across West Asia and into Asia for their own personal gain.
Right. Turning to the humanitarian aid situation in Gaza, Kim, some people have been crushed to death, you know, in the stampede. Some of them drowned while trying to get aid drop from the air. Some of them were hit by those, you know, airdrop aid. So this kind of, you know, aid airdrop, what I mean, has proved not only humiliating, but deadly. I mean, if the donors really want to help the people in Gaza, why don't they simply force Israel to open land crossings?
Indeed. I mean, that is the easiest and the quickest way and the honest, bona fide method of alleviating the suffering there vis-a-vis the humanitarian catastrophe aspect of it. You have to also look at who is creating that environment, who is doing this. It's the Israeli vicious regime. It's doing it because it uses hunger as a weapon of war. It wants to flatten out the whole of Gaza. The whole conflict is now becoming clear that it is about to do with the natural mineral resources of Gaza itself. Apparently, there's so much gas in the Sea of Gaza. There is a talk about turning Gaza into an attractive holiday resort, and said it by Jared Kushner the other day. I saw an interview, horrified to hear. This is the ultimate psychopathy. You don't have to be a psychologist expert to identify these people are very, very sick and dangerous people, because they don't seem to appreciate the value of human life. They don't seem to appreciate the importance of preserving a human life. Instead, they think any people can just be exterminated systematically, like they're doing it now. Whether using hunger as a weapon of war, or denying them access to basic necessities like medicine and water, and just outright shooting them and bulldozing them, and continue to attack the same hospital over and over again, raping women. There are allegations of rape taking place by the Israeli soldiers there. And it's month of Ramadan. People are fasting. We understand what it is to be hungry and thirsty. Can you imagine what it is like for the people of Gaza? That has been the situation for nearly 20 years for them, and now it's just been intensified. What needs to happen is, just like Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur at the Human Rights Council, said today, she's calling for sanctions and embargo on Israel. The whole world needs to now stop dealing with them, literally kick their embassy ambassadors out, close down their embassies, and tell them, you're going to stop this systematic extermination of these people, or else we're not going to talk to you, we're not going to deal with you. And of course, we need to reprimand and maybe even have them investigated, those countries that have been creating a land passage for the Israeli vicious regime, whilst the Gazans are starving. The air dropping off the food was pretty Hollywood movie stunt to make it seem like they care.
They're trying to do.
This is a classic example where a narcissist or a psychopath pretends to have empathy. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
So these guys are psychopaths, they're dangerous, and the Palestinian people need to be protected from the evils of these people.
All right. Now, Shabir, Israel saying it cannot defeat Hamas without going into Rafah, where it says the movement has 4 battalions composed of 1,000 fighters. Now, even if that is true, would that be the right thing? I mean, to wipe out the entire population there to achieve the goal?
No, of course not. There's no reason for this siege to even be happening in the first place. And I'm not just even talking about after October 7th, I'm talking about the history of the besiegement of Gaza. What they're asking to do, what they're trying to gain approval for before they do it, is genocide, is ethnic cleansing. There are hundreds of thousands, there's 1 million people in there. It's the last place they have to go. And guaranteed, no matter what they do, as we have seen time and time again, year after year, they say that they have targeted bombings. That's just simply not true. Their bombs are unguided, and what they're trying to do is massacre as many people as possible. They're trying to force them out. There is nothing surgical about this. And even if it was, this is a full-blown occupation, and it is an illegal occupation. Hamas has every right to exist. any resistance group has any right to exist, illegal occupation. This is under the UN's own law. What they're trying to do here is bend laws, is take advantage of the fact that they are politically and militarily backed by the United States and commit a massacre of untold proportions. We have never seen anything like this in history, where such a sophisticated military has backed all these people into a specific corner, has deprived them of food and medicine, has broken them psychologically, has broken them physically, and now wants to finish them off. They're asking the world for permission to commit a massacre that will surely finish off the population of Gaza, and they want the world's approval to do it, but they have become so illegitimized, they have become a pariah state, and they're going to be unable to do this. And now they're trying to make a gamble at it and say that they're going to go in, and it's just not going to work out for them. This objective that they have of destroying Hamas is not going to work. And they don't even consider that every time that they kill a Palestinian, who else is going to rise up to the task of joining the resistance and fight back?
Right.
This is something that they are not considering whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, in terms of the truce talks, now Qatar is saying that the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution has not had any immediate effect on the talks, for now, at least. The Israeli media said the talks had fallen through. They blame Hamas's response to a U.S. proposal for a prisoner swap. Now, Hamas is saying that Israel is entirely responsible for the failure of the negotiation efforts. So do you see a ceasefire deal around the corner?
I do hope so, but I can imagine, I mean, you know, going on a high-level negotiation meetings of this sort, it's a very tense atmosphere. I mean, as a commercial lawyer, I have attended these negotiation sessions. It's a very, very tense atmosphere, and you need to have parity between the negotiating parties, if you know what I mean, in the sense of, like, they need to be of equal strength. But here, we've got two parties of totally unequal strength. One party, which is supremacist in its ideology, in its position, in its assumption, it thinks it is superior to all other humans. And of course, in relation to Hamas, it sees itself as even more superior, and it sees Hamas as a mere hodgepodge of terror militia, which is not true, and they know it. But and so having negotiations in a room like that, it is filled with contempt by one side to the other side, and another side trying to uphold its rights with all it can, despite all the obstacles that it has in front of it. So it's a very difficult scenario, and I can imagine, I commend all those mediators who are in there, who are maintaining the peace in there. And so I hope there will be. I hope somebody will tell Israel, for God's sake, listen, the whole world now is aware of your heinous crimes. The whole world sees you as a proper psychopath. This is what you need to tell your client when you are in negotiating like that, and you know your client is unreasonable.
Okay.
You have to bear upon them and tell them, listen, you are going to have to come enter into a deal here, and if you don't, then it's going to backfire on you very, very badly.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this episode of the Spotlight. I apologize for that. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, joined me from London. Shabir Rezvi, political commentator from Chicago. Appreciate it.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 19.